As that sounds or seems, just realize the high school class, this is round three. Okay? So for those kids, moms and dads, be extra patient with them this evening when we get done. But I'm glad you're here. I'm glad we're gathered back together this evening to think about some things from the Word of God, some things to challenge us in our service to God. And if you're there, if you're still open in Acts chapter 17, the passage Bill just read for us, I really want to use that more as a precedent than really the text we're going to look at tonight. One thing you notice Luke recording Paul preaching there in Acts chapter 17, the Sermon on Mars Hill, is that Paul quotes one of their own contemporary poets. Paul says that there in preaching in verse 28, makes the observation, "For in him we live and move and exist, and even some of your own poets have said, for we also are his offspring." So really what I want to establish there is that that's really an approved apostolic example, right? That's the Apostle Paul quoting a contemporary source, a poet of their own, and then using that as a jumping off place to make a spiritual point or a spiritual application. And the poet that Paul quotes there is preserved for us by history. He's a Greek poet named Aretas. He was from Macedonia, actually from the region of Cilicia, so the same area Paul was originally from, and he was prominent in the 3rd century B.C. And he's one of the poets that Paul quotes here in Acts 17. And basically what he's saying is, hey, look, your own poets have made the observation that man is such that it's quite clear any origin he has or anything he's like would have to be divine. And he's using that to make the point, what he's going to say next, it's silly then for you to think that you should worship idols. Even your own poets have observed that that really doesn't make much sense. And so having them firmly established that an approved apostolic example exists of using a contemporary poet to establish a principle from which we would then make spiritual applications, that's what I want to do tonight. So let me quote a poet from our generation. That's Porter Wagner. I don't know how many of you are familiar with Porter, but he was a quite popular country and western singer back when it was both country and western in the 60s and the 70s. And if you read the description there, the picture proves that's an accurate description, right? He of the rhinestone suits, towering blonde pompadour, cornball jokes, and direct, simple songs. And Porter was quite popular. In fact, he had his own television show. Probably some of you remember watching that television show, and some of you think, oh, he's that tall, skinny guy that was on Dolly Parton's television show. No, Dolly was on Porter's show, okay? So Porter was a big deal in the 60s and 70s. But Porter had a song that I think would challenge us to look at some of the lyrics from it and make a case for some spiritual application. So the exact origin of this sermon is from my experience last year when I was preaching regularly over at Roundhill. And I know I saw Sean here earlier, and Marcus is here. I know they both know Brother Bobby Lindsay. So one Sunday after I had preached, we were talking after services, and Brother Lindsay, a member over at Roundhill, he said, "Do you know the song, If Jesus Came to Your House by Porter Wagner?" And I'm a big country music fan, so I know a lot of them. Usually if you ask me that question, the answer is going to be yes. But I said, "No, Bobby, I don't know that one." He goes, "Well, I've always thought that would make a good sermon." So I said, "Well, Bobby, I will go home and look it up on YouTube, and I'll see what I think." And I went home, and I looked it up on YouTube, and it turns out my friend was right. And indeed, Porter Wagner had written a song that would make a good sermon. And that's what I want us to look at tonight. And just this other thing, kind of a musical history note, I guess. This is one of those songs that was done in a style that's quite prominent in the 60s and 70s in country music. It was called a recitation. I don't know how many of you remember those, where the guitar plays kind of faintly in the back and the guy just talks the words. It was really rapping before rapping, I think. Guys like Porter Wagner and Red Solvine would do this. Some of his greatest hits would include like Teddy Bear and Giddy Up Go and that sort of thing. But this is the manner in which the song was produced, and I'll try to replicate it in my best Porter voice. But literally now, what I want you to do is pay attention to the lyrics, though. If Jesus came to your house to spend a day or two, if he came unexpectedly, I wonder what you'd do. When you saw him coming, would you meet him at the door with arms outstretched and welcome your heavenly visitor? I'm sure he said visitor because it rhymes with door when he said it. Or would you need to change some things before you let him in, like burn some magazines and put the Bible where they had been? Oh, I know you'd give your nicest room to such an honored guest, and all the food you'd serve to him would be the very best. And you'd keep assuring him that you were glad to have him there, that serving him in your home was a joy beyond compare. But what about your family conversation? Would it keep up its normal pace? And would you find it hard each meal to say a table grace? I assume that means pray before you eat, but that didn't rhyme with normal pace, so Porter calls it a table grace, but I think you get the point there. Or would you be glad to have him stay forever on and on? Or would you sigh of great relief when finally he had gone? You know, it might be interesting to know the things you'd do if Jesus came in person to spend some time with you. And I think once you kind of cut through a little bit of the cornball and get past it and just really read the words for what they're saying, what the lyrics are asking, there's some things to think about there, aren't there? Or at least I hope there are, because we're going to spend the next few minutes doing that. Let me suggest to you, if Jesus came to your house, would you meet him at the door? And I want you to think about that. There's certain visitors that when you know they're coming, you might meet them at the door, but why is that? It's because you're so excited about them being there, you keep getting up every few seconds and looking out, right? You know, you find reasons to walk by and kind of look out the door because there's somebody coming that you're excited to see, right? And that's the only chance I got of walking up and about to knock it and the door opening before I even hit it, right? I mean, that happens sometimes, but it only happens if there's somebody we're really excited to see. So what about that? Are you looking forward to it earnestly desiring Jesus is coming? Turn to 2 Peter if you would. Because in 2 Peter chapter 3, Peter there writing, that's the exact kind of point he makes. That ought to be what our perspective is. Beginning there, 2 Peter chapter 3, beginning in verse 10, starts with a warning that again is very central to the idea we're talking about tonight. He says, "But the day of the Lord will come like a thief, in which the heavens will pass away with a roar, and the elements will be destroyed with intense heat, and the earth and its works will be burned up. Since all these things are to be destroyed in this way, what sort of people ought you to be in holy conduct and godliness, looking for and hastening the coming of the day of the God, on account of which the heavens will be destroyed by burning and the elements will melt with intense heat?" Peter says we ought to be able to live in such a way that even we have the knowledge of knowing that when he comes back, this earth will be destroyed and everything about it will be destroyed, will burn up with intense heat. But we ought to live in such a way that we can say we're looking forward to and earnestly desiring the Lord's coming. We want to live in such a way that we are in fact ready to meet him at the door. And really that's the crux of the matter. Are we ready? Are you ready? Am I ready? And you think about the example of Paul in 2 Timothy chapter 4 verses 6 and 7. It's a passage you know well. Paul there nearing the end of his life, he lived in such a way that he was able to say, "For I'm now ready to be offered as a sacrifice. The time of my departure is at hand. Because I have fought the good fight, I have finished the course, I have kept the faith. And henceforth is laid up for me the crown of righteousness which the Lord, the righteous judge, shall give to me." But listen to what Paul said. "But not to me only, but to all those also who love his appearing." Several versions finish that verse by saying all those who long for his appearing. See, Paul lived in such a way that as he was approaching the end of his life, he could say with a confidence, "I'm ready. I'm ready because I know the Lord is a righteous judge and I know what he's promised to give me at the end of my life." And we need to try to live in such a way that as our life, if the end was to come in an unexpected way even, we could say we were ready. And really beyond just the idea of being ready, even anxious for the end. Do you realize that's the way the Bible more or less ends? Turn to the very back of the book of Revelation if you would. Revelation chapter 22, verse 20 there. And as John is summarizing and coming to the conclusion, this great book of these the visions and these things about future prophecy that he sees, when he starts to sum it up there in chapter 22, verse 20, says, "He who testifies to these things says," this is Jesus, your version probably has the next phrase in red letters, "Yes, I am coming quickly." To which John responds, "Amen. Come, Lord Jesus. So like Paul, John would have been ready, but even more than that, when you think about it, Lord, come quickly, is the idea that John is making there. So when you think about those things, when you ask the question, if Jesus comes to your house, would you meet him at the door? Would I meet him at the door? Am I looking forward to meeting him? Am I ready to meet him? Can I pray with confidence, Lord, come quickly? Secondly, I want to ask us a question. One of the lines from the song asks us this question. It's worth looking at. Would you need to change some things before you let him in? And we all know, really, when it comes to visitors, the world kind of boils down into almost two groups, really. So let's say, you know, if you were walking through the living room and you looked out the window and saw coming up your sidewalk, you've got a split second to decide which group that person belongs in, right? There are those that you would be so glad to see that you wouldn't make another thought but beelining for the door and opening the door, just be glad to see them, right? And then there are those where you think it's, oh no, I've got to do that. I don't have, the house doesn't look right. I've got to hide this. Where, you know, you think of everything. Maybe you shh and you hide so they won't even know you're there. You let them knock and walk right, right? But people, we'd have a different reaction to different type of visitors. Because there are some folks, before we let them in, let's be honest, we want to change some things, wouldn't we? I may have shared this with some of you before, but let me tell you, this even is codified. This is a policy like this. And in the Navy, I flew helicopters in the Navy, and we had a standing policy, and I had to do this one time. When somebody in a squadron was killed in a helicopter crash, as a matter of policy, one of us would go over and clean up before his parents got to town. I mean, why? Think about that. You know there's a good chance somebody has something they wouldn't want their mama to see, right? And we recognize that. And that was something we did. And that's hard. Go over and go through somebody's personal effects and get rid of the things that you wouldn't want their mama to see. But I think what that does is that recognizes the principle we're talking about, right? The general assumption is that if we knew somebody's going to be rifling through our stuff, we'd clean some things up. If we knew we were going to get a visit from some people, there's some things we would change. And let me suggest, if we knew the Lord was coming, are there some things that we would change before we let him in? Maybe there's some books laying around that we've read or been reading that we would want Jesus to know. Maybe we'd gather those up and hide them someplace. Maybe it's not that. Maybe we would realize that when he walks in and he sees the family Bible stacked right there by the door, he'd realize that that's simply where we lay them down when we get home on Sunday night, and that's where they're going to be as we head out the door on Wednesday night. When we get back Wednesday night, we're going to lay them back by the door there. So Sunday morning when we get up, they're laying right there by the door, because then Jesus would realize all they really are is an accessory for church. He'd realize it's not something that we spend time in every day, that we read and study. Or maybe magazines. Maybe clearly there's some types of magazines you wouldn't want Jesus to know you were looking at. Maybe it's just the volume of them. Maybe it'd be so obvious that the thing you're really interested in is not serving him and not the Word of God, just by the sheer volume of magazines about other things you have laying around. Or maybe you need to change that TV channel. Think about that, how bad some of the stuff, most of the stuff on television is these days. Let me, I'm talking to myself here about a lot of things, but does this sound familiar to anybody else? Do you ever remember maybe, let's say if you're newlyweds and you don't have kids, but maybe the first time your in-laws come over and you sit down to watch that show you always watch, and all of a sudden with your mother-in-law sitting there, that language seems a little worse, doesn't it? All of a sudden maybe you're cringing at stuff that you hadn't noticed that was that bad. What's the next evolution of that? Sitting there watching TV and a little two-year-old comes running. A few years down the line and you got kids, all of a sudden a two-year-old comes running and gets between you and the TV, and you'd be surprised what you hear. It's amazing some of the things that we become desensitized to, but now all of a sudden when you're forced to pay a little more attention, you realize that there's some things maybe we're watching that we wouldn't want Jesus to know we're watching. The principle here is what Paul talks about in the book of Philippians. If you turn there, Philippians chapter 4, in verse 8, very straightforward, very simple. Paul here, as he concludes, says, finally, brethren, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is of good repute, is there any excellence of anything worthy of praise, Let your mind dwell on these things. What is your mind dwelling on? What do you let your mind dwell on? What would the evidence laying around your house suggest you let your mind dwell on? And would you want to change that before you let the Lord in? Maybe you'd want to empty the fridge. Turn to Proverbs chapter 23 if you would. We know the writer there, the wise man writing Proverbs, beginning of verse 31 says, "Do not look on wine when it is red, when it sparkles in the cup, or when it goes down smoothly. At the last, it bites like a serpent, and it stings like a viper. Your eyes will see strange things, and your mind will utter perverse things." And if I'd listed every proverb even, or every verse had something to talk about the negative impact or side effects of alcohol, that I'd have had to have multiple slides. And that's not really the point of the sermon tonight. But I wonder, in a day and age when there are a lot of folks who now are willing to argue for the benefits of social drinking, or those that drink privately, even among that number, I wonder if there aren't some that are just so convinced that's a good thing, but they still might not want everybody to know they do it. That maybe if their mom and daddy were coming to visit, they might clean out the fridge. How much the more do you suppose if someone has questions about it, so they only do it in secret? Isn't that funny? You think you're doing it in secret, and we're talking about if Jesus came to visit. You know who already knows if you're doing that? But I just wonder how many of those that we hear champion the right to engage in social drinking wouldn't wonder, but think again about what's in the fridge as they saw Jesus walking in the door. Would you go empty the fridge if you knew Jesus was coming up the sidewalk? What about canceling some plans you have? Think about this. And let's just be very honest. Are there some people you hang out with that you wouldn't want to introduce to everybody you know? Are there some places you go that you wouldn't want everybody you know to know you go there? So if Jesus was coming to spend the week with you, would you have to get on the phone real quick and say, "Look, man, I can't make it. I don't know how long he's going to be here." You know, are there some things you would have to change? There's some people you hang out with that normally that you wouldn't want to. Some places you go where you know you shouldn't go, where you wouldn't say, "Jesus, we're going here with this crowd, you go with us." And you realize that just wouldn't work. Because the principle is true. 1 Corinthians 15:33, sometimes we're deceived. We allow ourselves, young people, it's easy to allow yourself to be deceived that these things don't matter. I can hang out with people that I really shouldn't hang out with, and I can go places I really shouldn't go and it won't bother me. But Paul there writing 1 Corinthians says, be not deceived. In other words, he knows you can deceive yourself, but says don't do it. Don't be deceived. Bad company corrupts good morals. So it makes me wonder if Jesus was coming to visit, would we change some of our plans? In 2 Corinthians chapter 6, Paul kind of expounded upon this principle here. 2 Corinthians 6, verse 14. Do not be bound together with unbelievers. For what partnership have righteousness and lawlessness? Or what fellowship has light with darkness? Or what harmony has Christ with Baal? And what has a believer in common with an unbeliever? The point is, are we close with some people who wouldn't want Jesus to know we were that close with? Are we involved in some things we wouldn't want Jesus to know we were doing? And will we have to change some of our plans before we let him in? What about your family conversation? That's another thing that was mentioned in the song. Would it go on like normal was the question basically that we were asked. First question comes to mind is, would you have to clean up your language? Are there things you wouldn't want to say because now Jesus was in the house? That shouldn't be the case. James 3:10 says that. It says, out of the same mouth, both blessings and cursings come forth. And brethren, that should not be the case. That's pretty plain and simple. That's what James says, that has no place in the life of a Christian to use that kind of language. But maybe that wouldn't be an issue. Maybe we don't use bad language. Hopefully sitting around the table with our family, if we even take the time to sit around the table with our family anymore. But maybe we would think seriously about what it is we do talk about. Maybe it would become more clear to us if Jesus was coming to have dinner with us that when we are there talking, how little we talk about spiritual things. You think maybe we would be more attuned to that? That maybe we'd realize that we spend this great amount of time together and we converse the whole time and all of it is about the weather or the ball game or the stock market or Fox News or something like that, that really in a grand scheme of things doesn't matter that much? And would it be one of those cases where now, well, Jesus is here, so we try to work some spiritual stuff into the conversation? One of those cases where you say something and the kids look at you like you're crazy because that's not usually what you talk about and you have to elbow them under the table or something like they do on television? But that shouldn't be the case. Turn to Deuteronomy chapter 6, but you know what it says. And I'm telling you, I think I have failed in this. And I'm willing to admit it, I haven't done this as well as I should in raising my sons. But I bet I'm not the only one can read these verses and realize more of this should have been happening. Look at some of the things we ought to be talking about around the dinner table. Deuteronomy chapter 6, beginning of verse 6. And these words which I am commanding you today shall be on your heart. And you shall teach them diligently to your sons. And you shall talk to them when you sit in your house. And when you walk by the way. And when you lie down. And when you rise up. And you shall bind them as a sign on your hand. And they shall be as frontals on your forehead. And you shall write them on the doorpost of your house and on your gates. In other words, you ought to be talking about spiritual things with your children all the time. And with sitting down to dinner with Jesus, just show us very quickly, we've not had our family conversation as focused on spiritual things as it ought to be. What about that question? Would it be awkward when you sit down to have that meal? Would you begin that meal with a prayer? Would everybody just know to bow to pray before they started fighting over the roles? What's the normal course of events at your house? I got to tell you, sometimes it could be a problem. Maybe you say, that's not really our habit. Well, you know what? Jesus wouldn't pick up his fork because that was his habit. I want you to follow me with all four of these verses because I'm going to go through all of them because it makes the point. Turn to Matthew chapter 26, if you would. Because what I want to impress upon us is as we go through all four Gospels, this indeed was the habit of Jesus, the creator, if you remember, the one who's first created all these things, he still gave thanks for them. Matthew 26, verse 26 says, and while they were eating, Jesus took some bread and after a blessing, he broke it and gave it to the disciples and said, take, eat, this is my body. And that's the night that the Lord's Supper is instituted, obviously. Turn over to the Gospel of Mark, Mark chapter 8. Mark 8 and verse 6, here at the feeding of the 4,000. Jesus there, Mark 8 and 6, says that he directed the multitude to sit down on the ground and taking the 7 loaves, he gave thanks and broke them and started giving them to his disciples to serve to them and they served to the multitude. Or look at the Gospel of Luke in verse 24, chapter 24. Luke 24 and verse 30, here's an episode after the resurrection, after he'd been traveling on the road to Emmaus. But here in this instance, Jesus chapter 24 verse 30 says, and it came about that when he had reclined at the table with him, he took the bread and blessed it and breaking it, he began giving it to them. And then John chapter 6. John 6 and verse 11, this time it's an instance of the feeding of the 5,000. But John 6, 11 says, Jesus therefore took the loaves and having given thanks, he distributed them to those who were seated, likewise also of the fish as much as they wanted. But the point is, the reason for that exercise in rapid fire succession of marching through all four Gospels is you see that it was clearly Jesus' habit. It was clearly his nature. It was clearly what he did was to be thankful and to give thanks before he ate. And that seems like a rather small thing. And certainly if we're not doing that, we'd probably want to do that if he was coming to dinner, wouldn't we? Let me suggest to you that if we're not doing that, it may be that we're overall neglectful of prayer. You know what 1 Thessalonians 5:17 says? Pray without ceasing. We understand it's not the idea of running around at all times with your head bowed and your hands put together. But the idea of having that attitude of prayer, continually of thankfulness. And if you live like that, if you pray without ceasing, that means when you do have those moments in the day, like you sit down to eat something God has blessed you with, or maybe when you first rise up and you're thankful for that night's sleep, or before you lay your head down at night, before a major decision is made, before a trip is taken, when you think about your brethren and other people that are going through things, it ought to be our habit to pray. And let me suggest to you that I think if we had a house guest, if Jesus was with us for a week or so, we'd probably find more time, more opportunity, and more reason to pray. But instead, it might be awkward. You know, if he's sitting there at the table and you're not even used to praying, you know, he knows. He's making intercession for you. You're praying through him normally. But just think about that. If it was awkward to pray with Jesus at the table, is that because you don't do it now? Because you don't really know him? Because you don't have that established relationship that you're used to talking to God through Jesus? That might make it hard, as Porter says, to say a table grace. What about this, ultimately, and if we be honest with ourselves? Another question that he asked in the song. Would you sigh of great relief when finally he had gone? When you think of all the things we've already talked about tonight, you know, you think there's a list of things maybe would be quite challenging. Maybe that would put a lot of pressure on us. Maybe that would make us have to be somebody we really aren't. And that'd be hard, wouldn't it? It's tiring to pretend you're something you're not, isn't it? Wears you out, playing a part. We have a word that literally means playing a part. That word's hypocrite. So if we spend all the time acting one way because Jesus was literally physically there and it wore us out, maybe we would be glad to see him going. Because you know what that would tell us? Now I can just get back to living for me. Go back to doing what I want to do. I can put it back in overdrive. I don't know if this has been helpful for you or not. I thought it was an interesting exercise as I listened to this song and as I read the lyrics. And I think if we think about this, it might challenge us a little bit. If we think about living in such a way, because you know, we don't know when Jesus is coming back, do we? We don't know when our death may hasten our moment to meet with him. And so ultimately then, in conclusion, I think Porter's right in the last stanzas of the song here. It is kind of interesting, I think, to think about. You know, it might be interesting to know the things you'd do if Jesus came in person to spend some time with you. So hope you'll think about that. But while you're thinking about it, I want you to realize this, and I think all of you already do. Porter phrases the question as a hypothetical, doesn't he? If Jesus came to your house. We all know it's coming. We don't know when, but there will be a time when Jesus comes to your house. When Jesus comes to my house. Whether it's at my death or whether I'm alive when the second coming happens, someday he will be my guest and he'll have a ticket to look at my life the way I live it. Will you be ready? That's the question. Will you be ready? You know he's coming as a thief in the night. We read that language in 2 Peter chapter 3. And again in 1 Thessalonians 5, he makes that same point. You don't know. You won't know till you hear the knock. Will you be ready? So ask yourself this question tonight. Are you ready? If you're here and you're not a Christian, you're not ready. But you can get ready tonight. If you believe that Jesus is the Son of God, if you believe he came and he lived a sinless life and he laid that life down as a sacrifice for your sin, if you're willing to repent or turn away from that sin in your life, to quit serving self and instead to serve Jesus, and you're willing to be baptized for the forgiveness or remission of that sin, that can all happen tonight. You can leave this assembly ready. If you are a Christian, hopefully this makes you think about this. Are you walking in the light? Does your life reflect the light of him? Does it something you'd be willing and gladly to open the door and show him the way you're living? It all boils down to this. If you knew Jesus was coming tonight, and you don't know that he's not, I don't know that he's not. If you knew he would come tonight, would you do something different? And if you would, do it now. If you're subject to the invitation in any way, we can help you. Simply come forward. Let us know right now while we stand and while we sing.